Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My name is Clyde Betts. I'm from Bermuda, former West Ham United football player. It's a pleasure being here with you all, and this is my second home, and I always look forward to coming back.
So let's start at the beginning when you were at home in Bermuda. What's your first contact with football when you were a kid?
Oh, I would say I probably around six, probably younger than that.
Yeah.
I remember getting the football for Christmas. And my eldest brother at the time, he ended up kicking the ball against the wall and the ball exploded. So that was my first disappointment of being with the soccer ball. But after getting a little older and going to school and playing with your mates in the streets and on the soccer fields, you know, you got a liking for it. And as I went through school, I went to an old boys' school and we played a lot of sport, and football and cricket was our main thing. And, you know, that's how I got into it. And as a matter of fact, I was telling Brian Deere today, my love for football started, I remember once seeing Tottenham Hotspurs when they won their first Fairs Cup.
Oh, yeah.
And that was in the 60s. And I said to myself then, hey, that would be a nice job to have. And from that day on, I just worked towards it and made sure that I was doing the things that I had to do as far as improving on your skills and stuff like that. And, you know, it worked out for me.
So you thought about it as the possibility of a job quite early on?
Yes, as a young kid, I knew
that's, wow,
that's what I wanted. Yeah,
that's interesting. Because you were a decent cricketer as well, weren't you? And
yeah.
your dad, if I'm right, was from Barbados.
Yeah,
so did your dad have an influence on that? Was he keen for you to choose cricket?
Well, I'm sure he would have liked me to have played cricket. He took me to Barbados the year they went for independence, and they got their independence, and that was my first trip to Barbados with him. And his best friend was Everton Weeks, Sir Everton Weeks, so they grew up together.
Oh, is that how you ended up meeting him?
Yeah.
Oh, right,
after
okay.
My dad, yeah, and he took me around to the schools with him where he was coaching. And at the end of it, he said to my dad, I want him to stay. But my dad came to me and he told me, look, you got a decision to make. It's either staying here playing cricket or I said, well, look, I'm going to take football.
Right.
Because I was in the national team in Bermuda when I was like 14, 15 years old.
Okay.
So I had a taste of traveling around the world and Pan Am games and Olympic games and stuff like that. So I knew then that I wanted to play. And to be fair to my dad, he, you know, hey, if that's what you want, we're going to make it happen. And he made sure that I had everything that I needed to play, boots and pads and all the stuff. And we lived in an area in Bermuda at the time, and we called Dockyard. And it was the British Navy base was in that area.
Okay.
So I got a chance to play with a lot of the guys from the British ships every day. So that helped my development. And when I came to England, I already knew how to take a kick, because they would give you some hammer. And we were like 12, 13 years old, and they would still boot you and tell you get up and go.
So you're like playing with men, so basically.
We were playing with men at a young age, you know. So when I came here, you know, it made it that much easier because I knew what I had to do. And, you know, after being in the youth team with a lot of the guys, I'm saying to myself, I'm over here on trial. You know, I said, I think I've got this, you know, to myself, because I was overstanded, you know, compared to a lot of the guys. That was a bit different, you know.
So how did you get set up with the trial with West Ham? I mean, what, you 17 at the time?
Yes, I was 17 when I came. Phil Woosnam, who played for West Ham, was in the North America Soccer League.
Okay.
I'm sure Phil had something to do with it. And my national team coach, a gentleman named Graham Adams, had been on some coaching courses, and Ron Greenwood was probably running them or showing them. And he made arrangements through Ron to let me come to England for a trial. And he accepted me, and I came, and that's all she wrote off of that. It was, you know, I knew I could do it. And I made a point to, hey, I've come this far. I'm not going back home. I've come to play football.
Was that the difficulty, adapting on a human level? Because you talk like quite nostalgically in your book about summers in Bermuda when you were a kid, and how you've got so much of the outdoor culture that you like to embrace. I mean, Britain, like in the late 60s, must have been a pretty great place when you arrived.
Well, it was, but this is what I wanted. And in order to do what I needed to do, Britain was the only place that I could come and play.
So you've got your business head on already at 17.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to do what was necessary. And my dad always taught me, hey, when you get here, you're not playing for yourself. You're playing for all the people that want to play, that can't play, all the people that work in the hospitals, the nurses of, you know, people from the islands. Those are the people you're working for, because they need somebody to help pick them up and get them going. And that was one of the things that I kept focus on and made sure that I, you know, done that.
So you often come back to the way your dad, like, quite openly says to you that you're a standard bearer for other people.
Yeah.
How conscious were you about being one of the first black players when you arrived in England for the first time?
Oh, well, I knew about it before I left, because at the time I was doing it, the first player of color that I saw was Albert Johansson.
Right.
And he played for Leeds then. But by the time I had come here, he had retired or finished playing. Then I had John Charles, who was at West Ham with me, and his brother Clive.
Well, you ended up living with their family, didn't you?
With their family, so yeah. I ended up staying with them. So they became my extended family away from home.
Sure.
And, you know, that's what happened, you know. And as I said, it was something that I knew I had to do, because, as you say, it wasn't many of us in those days. So I had to take the bull by the horns and say, hey, let's go do what you got to do. And, you know, it worked out.
But I suppose you look at that West Ham team, that West Ham setup then, and, you know, you think of Ron Greenwood being in charge. Mm. Think of a lot of your teammates, their names who trip off the tongue, Bobby Moore, Martin Peters, Jeff Hurst. This was only a couple of years after West Ham won the World Cup, as popular legend has it. Harry Redknapp was there as well. John Lyle was part of the backroom staff.
Yeah.
But what came across, I thought, in the book is you always seemed like you were very looked after by them, that you very much made part of the family. And Bobby Moore especially was someone who kind of took you under his wing.
Yeah, you know, I, as I've said this afternoon, you know, a person like Bobby, you know, he's one of the best human beings anyone on earth has or could meet. He was so down to earth. You know, he was willing to help you, you know, make sure you were doing the right thing. And regardless who it was, you know, it could be a young apprentice, you know, he had time for you, you know, and that's something that I would always remember him for. And is a person that I would never forget because, you know, he done a lot for me and with me and with all us young players at West Ham during that time. I mean, as you said, we had world-class players, but at West Ham, they were just another player, and that's the way they acted, and that's the way they wanted to be treated. I mean, as you say, for guys that have just won the World Cup, I mean, we had three of them in the same dressing room, you know, and it was a great feeling to know that, hey, I'm going to be on the same team as these guys. It was unbelievable because I remember watching that World Cup and seeing Eusebio and Pelé and all those play, and to be playing with three guys from the England team, you know, was a privilege and an honor, you know, and I would always be indebted to them because they helped me a lot during my development and during the way I, you know, was able to develop and play, you know, and people like Martin, and the last time I saw Martin, I, you know, thanked him. I remember playing a game once at Middlesbrough in the Cup, and I had scored three goals, but each one of them was offside because I didn't know really how to break the offside trap then. Mm. And Martin pulled me aside and he told me, whenever you're running through on 1-on-1, just run straight on the line, then make your turn.
So curve your run.
Right, curve your run and curtail your run. And I took that advice and he was right, you know, because... You know, if I had done what he had told me from the beginning, you know, I would have had a head trick and we probably would have been still in the FA Cup. But that day we ended up losing, I think, to Middlesbrough 1-0. And because I had them three goals disallowed, you know. But those are the type of guys that we're, as I say, playing with Jeff was a honor and a privilege because Jeff, for a big fella, had such a great touch. He had two good feet, could head the ball, and could turn on a dime, you know. And speaking with Brian today, you know, Jeff had a good teacher himself. He had a guy like Budgie Byrne, who played for Crystal Palace, who we bought from Crystal Palace to West Ham. And Johnny was a fantastic player himself. So, you know, West Ham have had a time in their history where we've had some fantastic players come through that place, and a lot's to do with Ron Greenwood. You know, he believed in playing football, and you know, you were taught the right way. You know,
we'll come to Ron in a minute, but you talked about some ways in which you needed to learn about the pro game. But on the other hand, I remember Harry Redknapp saying that the first day he turned up and saw you at the training ground, he was like, "This guy's big, he's not just got technique, but he can handle himself as well." And he thought you were 23 or 24. You're like 17, 18 at the time. So on the other hand, you're kind of somebody who's made for English football, right?
Yeah, I think being the size I was made a big difference to my game. I mean, it helped. What I learned in England was that they would tell you it's better to be a big good one than a little good one. And I believe in that because I remember one day playing against Tommy Smith at our place, and Tommy had this reputation of being hard and tough, and he wanted to hit me, and he ran into me, and I just braced myself. And when you look, Tommy was on his backside. You know, so it does help being big. And if you can play, all the better. I mean, you look at people like Jeff Estill. You look at people like Ray Kennedy. You know, John Redford, you know, Alan Gilzine, Peter Osgood, you know, the names go on and on. The boys that play for Stoke, big fella up front, was a good player. You look at Joe Royal, you look at Brian Kidd, you look at Man City, Mike Summerby, and Ronnie Lee was a little smaller than us, but he was
thick, stocky,
you know, and stocky, so he can take it.
So if we go to August 69, it's your debut at a very busy Upton Park against Arsenal.
Yes.
How are you feeling when you're coming out the tunnel?
Well, funny enough, I never really got nervous when I played. You know, it was an honor because I went to training on the Monday morning and that's how I found out I was playing.
Right, okay.
Ron called me aside and he said, "You ready to play?" And I said, "Ready to play." He said, "You're starting tonight. Go home and get your rest." So I went home, laid down for a couple hours, till it was time to go back to the stadium, and went out there and, you know, done what I had to do. You know, Arsenal at that time were, you know, a great team. Mm. They had some fantastic players. I mean, you had the little hard man, Peter Story. I'll never forget Peter. The one I remember going to tackle with, what's your name? Play for Arsenal, center back. Terry Neal was playing then, and Terry and I went over the top. I went over the top to him, and he chased me around the field all day trying to get me back. But it's funny because he went to become a manager at Hull, and I had to go to a hearing for one of his players when we played against Hull one day.
I really...
So we ended up pretty good friends, you know, but through that particular game, you know, he was out to get hold of me, but he couldn't catch me, so that was okay.
It's funny you mentioned Terry Neal. I remember him as a manager of Arsenal later down the line. And of course, we've already touched on Harry Redknapp, who of course we know as a manager here. But do people sometimes overlook what a player he was? Because you really enjoyed playing with him, didn't you?
Yeah, I enjoyed playing with H. He was a good cross of the ball. I mean, you know,
Beckham before Beckham.
Long before Beckham, I mean, yeah. When you think about it. I mean, and Harry would get to the byline and knock a good cross in. I mean, I don't know if Beckham got to the byline as much as Harry.
You know, early crosses.
Cross it in front of the defender. You know, but Harry would get to the byline and knock crosses in. And, you know, Johnny Sissons was another one, you know. So in those days, wingers done that. You know, today, I mean, very seldom see a person they're playing wide shaking the shoulder and dropping it and going to the byline.
They're meant to come inside and score goals, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. So it's a different time, you know, and different era. So you have to accept that. But Harry, he was a decent player.
And when you've played at West Ham for what, a year, the team goes to the US and does a little tour and you go back to Bermuda. And a lot of the players, and as we were saying before, these are world-class superstars who've won the World Cup and people know them. They're taken aback by the reception that you get when you get to Bermuda. How did that reception feel for you when you got back for that exhibition game? Did the penny drop about how influential you making it at West Ham had been, or did you know already?
Well, I knew already from the time I left that, you know, people were expecting good things, you know, because I was at a high level in Bermuda at that time as far as playing the game. I mean, during those years in Bermuda, we always had English teams coming to Bermuda. I mean, I remember playing against Chelsea when I was probably 16.
Okay.
Chelsea came to Bermuda. All of them used to come. Chelsea, we've had Celtic, we've had Coventry City, Tottenham Hotspur. So, you know, I knew to myself, you know, what the people expected and what they wanted. And I knew it was important for me to make the people happy. You know, hey, if I'm going to be coming, I'm coming to do business. I'm not coming to mess around and let it slip away from me, because lots of times in this profession, you are lucky if you get one chance, let alone two. So I've got one chance. So I have to make it happen now. By doing that, you know, people at home enjoyed it. I mean, I'm one of their own, And coming from a little place like Bermuda to come into a place like England, you know, made it that much better for them, because if we're 22 square miles, I mean, we can fit in Great Britain millions of times, you know, and to have a fella come here and to be able to play on the big stage with world-class players, you know, hey, made everybody proud, you know. And I'm glad, I tell people all the time, if the Lord picked me, I'm glad he picked me, because it's been a great ride and I've enjoyed it.
But there were difficult times in England, and you talk about it, especially in away matches, where you get some abuse. How did you deal with that? And how did you deal with that becoming a regular occurrence? And how did the club deal with that? How did Ron Greenwood help you out?
Well, lots of times, you know, through talking, sit down and talk. One of the biggest helpers was Bobby, because I'll never forget the time he come back from the World Cup. And the people in Colombia said he stole a bracelet.
Yeah.
So we were playing at Old Trafford this day. And they start singing, "Where's the bracelet? Where's the bracelet?
Yeah.
Where's the bracelet, Bobby Moore, in your handbag?" But he was that tough mentally. He just went up to the Stretford end and he started conducting the crowd as they were singing. And that was one of the most brilliant moves I've ever seen, because once he had done that, they stopped saying what they were saying and singing. And I said to myself, hey, if he could do that, you know, I could learn from that, you know. And by listening to the people throw abuse at you and call you all sorts of names, you got to be mentally tough, you know.
Did you block it out, or did it pump you up?
No, it pumped me up as well, and then I blocked it out. You know, you still hear it, even when you block it out, you still hear it. So you say to yourself, I'm going to show them. And I'll never forget one day I was at Everton, and they decided to pick on Clyde this day. And I said to myself, hey, this is not going to happen. I picked the ball up from the halfway line, and Terry Derricott was with me. And all he could do was hold on to my jersey. And I dragged him from the half line right to the goalkeeper. And as the goalkeeper came, I showed him a dummy. He more or less sat down. And I just dinked the ball over his head and into the back of the net. And Joe Royal came to me after the game. He said, Clyde, that's the best goal I've ever seen at Goodison Park. So for him to say something like that to me, because I liked Joe, the way Joe played. He was big, strong, good in the air, you know, when he was young playing with Everton. So I admired him as a player as well. So for him to say that to me, hey, that got me going.
But some of the abuse was more serious. I mean, the thing, I guess, that's really striking in the book was when you talk about the letter you got in 1970 threatening you with an acid attack.
Yes.
Now, and that's, I guess, where the title of the book, The Acid Test, takes its name from. I mean, that's different. Words are one thing, however unpleasant that may be. An actual physical threat on your person is something else. How did you deal with that?
Well, we, you know, Ron and I sat down and we talked about it and had a plan for what we're going to do. You know, I applaud a lot of the guys because they put me in the middle and like formed two groups outside and let me go in the middle.
Okay.
And so if anything happened, you know, it wasn't going to be on our watch, you know, so to speak. So the police were there, they were made aware of what was going on, and they more or less protected me, and, you know, everything worked out okay, you know, but it wasn't a nice thing to have happened. I would like to be able to see the person up until this day. I mean, and look him in the eye and say, you know, you really want to throw acid in the person's face. That's not normal. You know, that's not normal.
You know, I suppose you don't know what's a threat and what's actually a genuine possibility.
Right. You have to take precaution.
How long was it in your mind for after that?
I still think about it sometimes a day.
Right.
I mean, you know, to, you know, have someone do that sort of stuff to you, you know, it's something that you don't erase, you know, like that, even though it's been like almost 50 years, but I will always remember it, you know. And as you say, you don't take things for granted, because you don't, there's always going to be somebody out there that is not going to like you. And I've learned that over the years. I mean, you might have some people that don't know you from Adam.
Yeah.
Just hear you speaking on the podcast. And
just so form an opinion
like
of you.
I don't like him.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
sure.
I've learned that through life, you know. Everybody you come in contact with is not going to like you. So you have to learn to live through that and do what you have to do and do what you think is right and the right thing. And if you stand up to it, you're doing something. If you just lay down, it's no good. You can't lay down.
So how's your daily life in London? I mean, did you receive any abuse in daily life, or was it only ever on the terraces? I know you had a sort of mini community of people from Bermuda around you. Your brother just lived up the road in Norwood, didn't
he? He was in Norwood, yeah.
So did you feel safer once you banded together, or did you feel okay in your day-to-day life in London?
Well, we were talking about it today. The street that I stayed in the East End London with the Charles family, nobody would touch us.
Right.
Because they knew coming down Ronald Avenue causing trouble, you're going to take some licks or somebody's going to chase you, so you don't come down that end of the street and mess around. I mean, in the East End London, you know what the East End London's like in those days. I mean, when I look at it now, I mean, it's unbelievable what they've done to that part that used to be the roughest part at one time.
Yeah.
Through the Olympics and stuff like that. I mean, it's beautiful. But in our day, hey, you had to put your boxing gloves on.
Sure.
To get out of there. So I had a lot of friends that were, you know, from that area, and they weren't going to mess with me because my friends, I know, would have looked after me and taken care of me.
And I suppose West Ham in itself was a sort of safe space. You've talked before about how progressive Ron Greenwood was, and to him, like, colour really wasn't important.
Yeah.
But on Easter Saturday in 1972, you beat Spurs 2-0, and West Ham become the first team in England to put three black players in the starting 11.
Yeah, I remember.
Big moment? Game.
It was a big moment. What was more important was that the team was so young at that time. I mean, that day, everybody was injured. I think Jeff was injured. Bobby was injured. You know, Martin, I think, had gone to Spurs by then. And he put all these, all of us were like, the average age was like under 20. And we were able to go out, and we beat Spurs 2-0, as you said, 2-0 or 2-1, something. I remember Eddie Coker scored in that game. And
he's a few years younger than you as well, wasn't he?
He's 2 or 3 years younger than me. Clyde was the same age as I. And it was great to see us three. I usually tease Cyril whenever I spoke to him before his passing. I said, Cyril, you guys were in the first 3 degrees, you know. I say us three at West Ham, we were the original 3 degrees.
Yeah, damn right.
Just the Johnny Come Lately ones. And I knew Brendan from Arsenal when he was at Arsenal, Brendan Betts, you know, so I used to tease him all the time about that, you know.
I suppose that you did have your moments, though, where it was a steep learning curve. I mean, you know, we talked about you growing up with absolutely fantastic world-class players like Bobby Moore. Jimmy Greaves was there later on. And there was that night before the FA Cup tie at Blackpool in 1970. Come on, you knew I was going to bring it up.
Yeah, I did.
And you thought the game was going to be called off.
Well, we were told, by the referee.
You got an invitation to the 007 club.
Yeah.
You went, and then the game actually happened.
We switched again,
And the result didn't go well for West Ham.
The result went horrible for West Ham, but it wasn't that because the guys had too much to drink.
Yeah.
You know,
because it was Bobby Moore, Jimmy Greaves,
Brian Deer.
Oh, Brian, right.
Frank Lampard. And
Frank Lampard Senior was was he?
Myself and my trainer, Rob Jenkins. And the funniest thing about it, when you pick the paper up on the next day, they had made a cartoon character, a picture out of us. As a matter of fact, Brian Deer has added on his phone. He showed it to me this afternoon.
That happened in 1970 as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, it was. And the reason we got beat really was because of Tony Green, the fellow that was playing for Blackpool.
Right.
He was like a ballerina on ice. I mean, this day was snowy. Snow came and was coming, came down all day. And he was able to master that better than anybody out there that day. And they ended up beating us. I think it was 4-1. And we got slammed for it, you know, which is rightly so. You know, but I don't want people to get the impression that we were drunk, you know.
Well, you were drinking orange juice anyway, weren't you?
My favorite drink then was ginger beer and lime.
All right. Well, yeah. There you go.
So, you know, it's just might as well as drink orange juice, you know. But, and we understand how fans feel when you go out and you get a good threshing, you know, but it wasn't because they alcohol or anything or late night. It wasn't that late. We were in bed before 12.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got back early and, you know, we just never thought the game was going to be on. You know?
But did the perception of what happened, I mean, it affected Bobby Moore's relationship with West Ham, didn't it?
It, in some way, it probably did. I tell people all the time, hey, Bobby Moore to me, you know, you can touch Bobby Moore. Nobody at West Ham can touch Bobby Moore
for sure.
When it comes to football. He's the god of West Ham United, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to football. Then you got a person like Jeff, you got Martin, you got Billy Bonds, you know, and Trevor Brooken. You know, these are people that, you know, you elevate because they deserve it. And that's simply because of what they've done for West Ham. And as I say, us guys that were there that night, hey, we made a mistake. You know, in life, everybody makes mistakes, you know. But don't hang me for a mistake like that. You know what I mean? Hey, it's just something that happened, you know. Mm. And it could have happened to anybody. It was just unfortunate that it had to be us five or six of us. And I'm sure if you spoke to everybody, they would tell you, you know, that would never, it never happened again. You know, we learned from a mistake and we understood that, hey, when you go out, you got to behave yourself, carry yourself a certain way, and don't go out the night before a game. We knew that. Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
After your time at West Ham, you went off to North America.
Yes.
And, I mean, people talked about there being interest in you from other First Division clubs. What made America an interesting left field idea into reality?
Well, because I had been there the summer of 75 and I went out on loan. Eddie Fermani, who used to be Charlton manager then, came over to America. I had an agent, the same fellow Bobby head called Jack Turner, and he got in touch with Jack and wanted to know if I wanted to come for the summer. I said, yeah, why not? You know, I'm, you know, haven't played much this season, so, you know, I think it'd be a good thing if I was to go and play. So when I came back for preseason, you know, I'd be in tip-top shape. So he let me go for that summer, and it was a fantastic time. We had a good team. I mean, John Boyle from Chelsea. We had Johnny Sistens from West Ham. Stuart Jump from Stoke. Stuart Scullion from Watford. Myself, Derek Smithers from Chelsea. Paul Hammond was goalkeeper from Crystal Palace. Mark Lindsay. You know, so we had a fairly decent team, and we ended up winning the championship that year. So, you know, it was nice to go and help develop soccer in America, so to speak. And
was that the feeling you had, that it really was something that was in development?
It was new. And it was nice to be a part of that, you know, new era, so to speak, because at the time we went to Tampa, I mean, we might have started out with 1,500 people, but by the time we left, we were filling the stadium with 60,000 people.
Wow.
So, you know, that was a big improvement, and it was because the team was successful. And you got to remember, no matter where you are in the world, sports people like their team winning.
And you had a bit of a rivalry, actually, didn't you, with the Cosmos?
We had a big rivalry with the Cosmos.
Because Pelé turned up at roughly the same time as you?
Pelé came the year after me. Pelé, Carlos Alberto.
Beckenbauer a couple of years later.
France came probably a year later.
Yeah.
Niskens, Wim Rijsbergen, all these guys that come over. Eusebio was in Toronto.
Didn't you end up playing with Cruyff when you were guesting with the Aztecs?
With the Aztecs, yeah. I played with Johan. I've got to know Johan very well from playing against him and with him on tours, because lots of times they were going tours to different parts of the world with either the Cosmos or the Aztecs, and they would invite me to come with them. So I got to know him and Pelé very well, yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because we think of football as being very partisan in England, but it does seem that you're all like working together to make football grow there.
Yeah, we understand the task that we had, and you know, everybody was on board of trying to do the best we could. And as I said, the NASL, I mean, we drew some decent crowds. I mean, when you had your final game, what they call the NASL championship final, I mean, was always broadcast live on national television. And New York, you would get 50 to 60,000 people there watching, you know, the final, because you must bear in mind there are a lot of foreign people in the United States of America that grew up with football. So it makes it a bit more easy to get the people into the stand. And you got a drawing card like Pelé, people are going to come watch you anyway, you know.
And so if we look at football today, we'd like to think we've come a long way from when you started out in the 60s and when you had to put up with that abuse, when you went to away grounds, when you went to Everton and Leeds and Leicester and all these other places. But we're seeing more issues at the moment with racism in stadiums. Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think people that are in position need to do more.
In positions of power?
Yeah. Need to do more to prevent this from happening. I mean, you look at the other day when you had England playing in, was it?
Bulgaria. Yeah.
And they done that. You know, FIFA or UEFA should come out and say, hey, we're going to bend them for 2-3 games to hit them where it's going to hurt them. And that is financially. Because you get England going to Bulgaria playing, you're going to get a packed house. Now, if you say to them, hey, the next time there's a game, international game, we're not going to let no spectators come, you know, that's going to be a punishment for you. But nobody takes that initiative to say that we're going to hit them where it hurts, you know. So they let them just go and come back the next week and taunt and throw chants at the next group of players of colour that are going to be coming.
So do you think part of the issue with the people in positions of power who can maybe affect this not being able to deal with it, do you think there are just not enough people of colour represented
that
in those positions of power?
That probably has something to do with it too, because you got to remember, a person of colour playing and being abused on the field every day, they know what it feels like.
Yes.
The average person that is not of colour, they don't know what it feels like because it doesn't happen to them, you know. But if it happens to your teammate that is a person of colour, you know, he if he doesn't hear it, something's wrong. You know, he's going to hear it. And
yeah.
If you're not strong enough, it can really affect you.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to work hard as people and not just in England, worldwide. Hey, don't judge a person because of the color of the skin. Judge him what he brings forth to the table, so to speak, you know.
So, I mean, you spoke, an interesting idea in your book was you were talking about players, like prominent black players, maybe being sent to countries where you have had this sort of abuse to come face to face with fans and, you know, kind of, I guess, remove the barrier so they realize that there's an actual person behind who you're abusing. I thought that was a really interesting idea. I mean, does it sort of plug into, say you've got someone like Raheem Sterling, who's not just an incredible player, but someone who's become a prominent figure in society because, okay, he hasn't done that and he hasn't been asked to do that, but what he has done via social media is gone, look, this is me, not talking through the club, not talking through an official statement, this is me directly saying this is what I think is unacceptable and this is how I'm challenging it.
Well, I would say to him, power to him. I think that's a good thing, you know, because you got to remember it's a different era. They get things done a lot quicker because of things like that you're playing with right now.
it's just my notes. I'm not checking my mails.
You see? So, you know, you have to admire him for that. You know, my advice to him was be to continue doing what you're doing. You know, don't let them knock you off course of what you want to do. And, hey, just keep fighting for what is right, you know, because I say one thing every time I speak on this subject, the ball doesn't care what color you are. As long as you know how to play, the ball's going to let you have a part of him and you can keep it to your feet. If you can't play, the ball's going to go all over the place.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
See? So my thing to Raheem would be, hey, continue doing what you're doing and remember there are going to be people coming after you, so you have to make a platform for them when they come along.
And when we talk about black people being in positions of power, you moved into football management of sorts in 1996. By that time, you've retired. You're settled with your family in the States where you continued living after your retirement. But then you get the call from Bermuda with the offer to be technical director.
Yeah, it was a good thing. It's something that I always wanted to do, was to go home and try to give something back.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's important. And I would advise every footballer in the world, if you are doing something overseas and you're doing something very well, don't be afraid to go back home and contribute and give something back, because that's what's going to help to make the world a better place. You know, and especially today, these guys are making mucha. Bucks. So, you know, don't be afraid to give. If you see somebody on the street that needs help, go and help them.
Well, I suppose we'll come to your foundation in a minute, but in terms of football, it's not just about the money, is it? It's about the experience. I mean, what did you feel was the gap when you started helping out with the Bermuda national team? Obviously, you've got someone like Sean Gota, who by working his way up, eventually like became a Manchester City legend here, and he's still very much loved by Manchester City fans. But what was the gap between what you'd experienced in England and the States and the sort of facilities and the, I guess, management structure that existed in Bermuda?
Well, definitely, it's not of the level that we have here, you know, especially when it comes to facilities. Our facilities are nice, but,
sure.
you know, we need to get them better. You know, I think it's always going to be a battle when you pit amateurs and professionals together because the mentality is different, you know, and in Bermuda, most of our guys are amateur. You know, we're getting more players now coming over this part of the world and applying their trade, you know, playing in the semi-pros and lower divisions. That's a good thing for the country, you know, and because I'm a believer, if I've got somebody playing here, it's going to be better than what I have where I'm coming from because the standard there in Bermuda at the time is not as high as it should be. And the way it used to be, you know, because as we said, children today are not outdoorsy children. Most children today are in the house doing what? Playing with the computer. You see, and I tell a lot of players today, get off their computers, come outside and apply your trade. That's how you learn the game.
Well, a child's instinct, before all that is introduced, is to be outside, isn't it? Children are basically the same, aren't they?
Well, they should be, you know, but because of the modern technology, you know, I mean, children today, you know, are not children to be outside for some reason, you know, and you blame the parents as well because a lot of the parents will give Johnny a computer or a telephone to just sit there and play, to keep him quiet. You know, I mean, I have nephews and great nephews. I have one in particular likes his computer. When he comes to me, I tell him, you're at my house, you got 1 hour. After that, go outside and play. You know, because you can't be on these things all the time, especially if you want to be a good sports person, because this thing doesn't teach you how to do a blindside run or do a third man run. Or something like that. You have to be on the field to be able to learn that sort of stuff.
So. And your foundation plugs into grassroots, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's about developing young players and education. It's also got a particular focus on goalkeeping. How did that come about?
Well, we've always felt that we need to have good goalkeepers, and not anybody could coach goalkeeping. You know, goalkeeping, I think you're better off having the person that has done goalkeeping coaching to coach the goalkeepers. I mean, if you say to a fullback, go take the goalkeepers, you know, he's not going to really know what to do. Like a person that has been in goal week in and week out that can spread the gospel to the goalkeepers. So if we have to send somebody away or have someone come in to help them, those are the sort of things that we like to do.
And you've got a Bermudan goalkeeper over here now, haven't you? You've got Nathan Trott at West Ham, who's at Wimbledon at the moment.
Yeah, but Nathan, I think England have taken him from us.
Yeah, they have, haven't they?
You know, that's the sad thing about playing here is that now that we have the British Brass Board, you know, our kids have a double choice. You know, you have two choices. You either can play, if you're good enough, England are going to pick you if you're good enough. You know, with Nathan, they saw something in him. And he is a darn good goalkeeper. And, you know, he's got the decision to make when the time has come. When the time comes, I know what decision I would make if I were him, but that's up to him, you know. But those are the things that you have to go through, you know, when you're on that side. You know, and as I said, I'm a believer in you got to give something back, you know. And this is my way of trying to help my school, whether it be trying to get them in university or helping them to go to college if they can't afford it, or, you know, helping them to go get trials if they haven't got the money to go. You know, that's the sort of things that I enjoy doing. And as long as I've got the golf tournament and the foundation, that's what I'll continue to do.
And it does stuff for cancer awareness as well and helps people with treatment.
Yeah, we try to get involved with cancer, and the reason mainly, my daughter, she was diagnosed with cancer at like 33 years old, and she's doing wonders. She's 10 years clean. We got it early, which is a good thing. And she goes every year back to Boston to have a check to make sure everything's okay. And that's one of my main reasons for wanting to help people with cancer. And as I've said to you earlier, this game is so powerful. We could do a lot more, you know, than they're doing. Because you look at it, the people around the world that don't have drinking water. Should there be people this day and age around the world not having drinking water?
That's true.
Now, if we took a game in Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, we took a game at Giant Stadium, New York City, or the Rose Bowl. We took a game in England. We put a game in Germany. We put a game in Italy. You put a game in Spain, even Russia. There was a 7 countries. If we had everybody playing that same time, look at the money you're going to raise.
You're talking about a whole Live Aid thing, really.
Right.
Yeah.
And look what you're going to do. And look at the people you'll be able to help if you were to do stuff like that. And a lot of the people that are in that area, those are the things that they need to look at, you know, because they're this day and age, it shouldn't be people suffering like they are when it comes to 2020 coming up, you know, and you still have people like that in the world. So as I said to you previously, if you're a footballer and you can afford to help somebody, try and help them.
Finally, we've taken up loads of your time, Clive, and I thank you for being so generous. While you're over here in London from Bermuda, you're going to be taking a little trip to West Ham, of course. How does it feel when you go to see West Ham? Obviously, it's not Upton Park anymore, but do you still get that old feeling? Do you still get that feeling from the club? I know you watch them most weeks. That's the beauty of modern technology, isn't it?
Well, as I said, modern technology is fantastic. I mean, it affords me the opportunity to do things like that. You know, I just look at it when it comes to the playing side. Sometimes you need to forget that and put it down and go out there and actually do the work yourself, you know, rather than worry about that technology. But coming back and being at the Olympic Stadium, from a club point of view, I think it's a fantastic thing that they were able to get the Olympic Stadium in the first place, because it affords us the opportunity to generate more income, you know, for the club and for getting players.
You're still hopeful for that, that they'll be able to do that?
I hope so. I mean, we're drawing, 50, almost 60,000 people now, you know, so hopefully in the near future, they're going to be able to start spending that money on that. I don't know how much they have to pay to the rental of the stadium. I'm sure it's a decent amount of money, but you know, it'd be nice someday if they can get their own, like Tottenham have done and Arsenal have done, because that way, you know, you can see exactly what you're going to be doing, you know, what you got coming in, what you got going out, you know.
So it'd be nice to let, like, some more local people in cheaply, wouldn't it, as well? Because football's really expensive nowadays.
Football is unbelievably expensive. I tell my wife, I don't know if I would go if I lived in England right now.
Yeah.
Because if you want to go and take your family, you're probably looking at about £300-400 a game, wouldn't you? If you're going to be eating food and drink and stuff like that.
Oh, the kids always want to eat. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So it'd be nice if they can come up with something where they can look after the fans at least, you know, and give them now and again a cheap ticket or something to come and watch, you know, because as you said, it's very expensive.
Fingers crossed. Well, look, thanks so much for joining us anyway, Clive. I hope you enjoy the game and I hope you enjoy your time over here.
Long as West Ham win, and I'll be happy, you know.
Thanks so much, Clive.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man.
tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.